So for some of us, Christianity is not working at all. You have tried to believe, but you're plagued with doubt. You have tried to hold on to mercy, but you feel guiltier now than ever before. You want to see change in your life. You know that bitterness is eating you alive, and you don't want to be that way. You drink too much. Not because a religious person says don't drink, you just, in fact, drink too much. You have self-hatred, and you're willing to starve yourself or cut yourself, hurt yourself, and you know there's no life there for you at all. You're overcome with self-righteousness, and the moment that you walk into a room, everybody tenses up, and your opinions overwhelm, and you divide, and that's not really who you are or what you want to do, so you want change. And you felt some of the pain of the issues in your life, and you've experienced the consequences of it, and yet nothing is happening. And to be clear, the change that we're looking for, the change that we're talking about, is not some new level of fanatic adherence to dogma. Religious reformation is useless. It's not the point at all. We're not trying to become more presentable in our Christianity and look like nice Southern men and women on the outside. We want lasting transformation that only Jesus can bring. We want him to come into our relationships that are estranged with our loved one and reconcile those relationships. We want to no longer hate ourselves and be free from the addictions that hold us captive. We want to be able to lessen our anger issues as God changes our hearts from very tender hearts to very sweet hearts that are full of the goodness of God. We want this change from death to life. And if you don't think that you need that change, it's because you're eaten alive with pride. Just to ask people around you. So you've prayed and you've read books about change and you've listened to sermons and you've gone to conferences and you've begged the Lord, but it doesn't seem like Christianity is working at all for you. If you're in this place, I think one of three things could be happening why a change isn't occurring in your life. The first is you've bought into a form of Christianity that is religion, and religion at its core is based in legislation. You create some rules, some laws, and if you adhere to those, you become a better person, and everybody else who does is part of better humanity. So we make ridiculous laws like thou shalt not drink box o' wine, and thou shalt not pull for the devils of any kind, and thou shalt not listen to 21 Pilots. These rules that would better society at the core. But for some reason beyond imagination, you still listen to Stressed Out by 21 Pilots. And so it just isn't working. And it's not working because legislation has no power to change the heart. And so you're failing in your Christianity. Nothing is transformed. And it's because you've given yourself over to something that can't possibly work. That's potential one. Potential two is Jesus. We believe that Jesus is lovely and grand and the King of Kings, and he's a good father who chases his prodigal sons and his prodigal daughters. And the moment that he finds them, he runs out to them and greets them and brings them home. We believe that Jesus is worthy of every single second of your life. But Jesus could be a fraud. It could be just a character made up by disciples in the first century. He was a good teacher, but more than that, no, I don't think so. And so he didn't really walk on water. He just was close to land. And the disciples thought he was walking on water. They just conjured the story up. He didn't really feed 5,000 people. He had 5,000 tuna sandwiches in a cave behind him, and it was time to break out lunch. He just started feeding people. He's just a fraud. And so nothing is changing in your life because Jesus isn't God, and therefore you can't be changed by him. Or number three, Jesus isn't a fraud. He's actually lovely and capable of changing your life. And Christianity isn't a religion. It's a following of Jesus. It's adoration and worship. And so the problem isn't Christianity and the problem isn't Jesus. It's me and it's you. We're the issues and we're the problems. There's something in our life that's halting the movement of the Spirit. There's something quenching the love of the Father. There's something that's just shut down the work of Jesus in our lives. Every time he builds something beautiful in our lives, we willingly and knowingly go and tear that thing down. And so what we're going to see today is one of the best passages in all of the scriptures of how people change. We're going to see two different debtors, both owing something to Jesus. And their response is quite interesting. They both see what Jesus is doing. And they both hear what Jesus is saying. They need something from Jesus, but radically they respond differently. One is transformed, one is blown away, one is grateful and falls down in worship and adores Jesus. The other is guarded. and cynical and distant and has no opportunity to really look at who Jesus is because he's focused on himself. And so to set up the response and to set up how change happens, we need to understand the scene of Luke chapter 7, and then we need to know a little bit about the characters, and then we'll jump into the response. So let me set the scene for Luke chapter 7 for you. Earlier in this passage, Jesus is walking through a city, and he sees a funeral procession. And he's observing what's happening around this funeral, and he sees the mother weeping uncontrollably, and she's lost her son. And Jesus is filled with compassion, which means he enters into her condition and he feels her pain and he understands her loss and he weeps with her. And so he walks over to this dead boy on a processional and he does something that has never been done before. Freely, he just starts giving out resurrection. It's bizarre. It seems impossible. He doesn't want the woman to suffer anymore. So he looks at the boy and he says, "Arise and walk away." And sure enough, this boy gets up and he walks away. Now, whenever an event happens like this, some people believe and follow, and other people become more cynical, and they set out to disprove that it happened. But something occurred that ignited this group of people in profound and deep ways. Then right after that, a man named John the Baptist, who was the first prophet for 300 years. A prophet calls people back to the compassion of God that we saw in Jonah a few weeks ago. John the Baptist is calling people to come back to God and be changed by this compassion of God. Now he's found himself arrested and he's going to be beheaded soon. And so he starts asking questions. Has my life had any value and meaning? Did I just waste all the days of my life? So he sends some friends to Jesus and asks Jesus, "Are you really the one? I told people that you were the redeemer, the rescuer. I told people you were the savior of the world. Are you really the one, or should I look for somebody else? Because my life is almost over." And Jesus answers his friends by quoting Isaiah chapter 42. And he says, "The lame will walk, and the sick will be healed. The blind will see, and even the dead will return to life." But there's this one part of Isaiah 42 that Jesus left out. Part of the core identity for Israelite is when the Redeemer comes, the captives then will be set free. They had been enslaved by empire after empire. They were tired of slavery. They wanted to be set free. That was the key thing. And so when Jesus leaves it out, it seems like he just forgot the most important part, especially if you're John the Baptist, who's a captive about to be beheaded. So this leads up to a pretty amazing event, where Jesus is seen by two people and change happens in both of their lives, but only one is really redemptive change. So let me introduce you to the characters. The first character is a guy named Simon. He's very respectable. People look up to him. He's a Pharisee. And we meet him in chapter 7, verse 36, and then again in verse 39. It says this: "When one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him, he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table." In verse 39, "When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself," and this is after the woman had come in, "if this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner." So a Pharisee was a religious leader who believed they were right with God because they kept 613 different laws. They were famously pompous. They were Jesus's primary antagonistic people, and they flaunted what they believed to be the perfect religion and drew attention to themselves. Now, Simon was interested in Jesus, but it didn't go any farther than just basic interest. He treated Jesus like Jesus was a circus performer. He refused to believe that Jesus was great. He refused to believe that there was anything other than him tricking people to believe that he was a rabbi or a teacher. And he was setting out to prove that Jesus was a fraud. How could you claim to be God and forget Isaiah chapter 42? I'm going to invite you over and instruct you and correct you because you're just pulling the wool over people's eyes. He was inviting over to correct Jesus. He couldn't believe in the resurrection of a boy. So he sets out like a reporter to find events, to find the timeline so he can see how the trick was performed. And he's trying to do this, but there's one thing that's bothering him to the core, and that's why he's willing to ask Jesus over to his house. He had seen the dead boy. He had paid his respects to the dead boy's mother. He had watched the funeral procession. He had seen and touched the cold stone dead body. And then, without any plausible explanation, this little boy gets up and walks away. And it messes with Simon to the point where he has to ask Jesus over. And wants to make it very clear to Jesus, we'll talk, we'll have conversation, I'll listen to you, but there's not going to be adoration, there's not going to be worship, there's not going to be this profession that you are God. Just come over and we'll see what transpires after that. That's Simon the Pharisee. Here's the woman. We meet this woman in verse 37, and then I'm going to read verse 39 again. It's the hinge verse of this passage, and we learn something important about the woman. It says this, a woman in that town who lived a sinful life learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house. So she came there with an alabaster jar of perfume. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner. This woman, some scholars believe it was Mary Magdalene, who was a close friend of Jesus and who was the first one to see the resurrection of Jesus. Others say, no, it was Mary of Bethany, Mary the sister of Martha, the one in John chapter 11 and John chapter 12. And yet still other scholars say it wasn't either one of those. We're not real sure. So for simplicity, we're just going to call her Mary today. So we're dealing with Mary and Simon. Those are the two characters along with Jesus. Now, this woman lived a difficult life. Everywhere she went, everybody knows her sin. Can you imagine that? That everywhere you go, people point at you and they don't call you by your name. They don't call you by what you've done in your life. They just call you by your sin. Not many of us, few, if any, have to deal with that. We can hide our sin. We can put it in a box and put it over in the corner, close the door to the closet and invite people over and maintain our religiosity and maintain our pride while we point and judge other people. But this woman, no, everybody knew. She was a prostitute. She was a woman of the city. Men ogled her. Men would undress her and play fantasies out in her mind as she walked by. And they would say things that were inappropriate. That was the life that she lived. Women hated her. They hated her because they blamed her for pulling their husbands into her bed and for drawing their sons away from the one true religion. It was her fault, though really it was the men's fault. But human nature is to pull close those you love most and blame and accuse others. And so this woman lived this life. What I'm hoping to do as we spend time in this passage is to peer into her story and see how Jesus changes her in hopes that we can identify with her, see that we need change, and then be aware of how Jesus might change us. And I think the starting point is this. We need to understand that her life is much more similar to our life and her culture is much more similar to our culture than we want to give credibility to. It's easy at times to put the Bible to the side and say, if it was written a little bit more recent than ancient times, it might speak more loudly into our lives. These people were primitive. They were very simplistic with no complexities at all. They weren't very intellectual. And so everything the Bible says deals with that ancient culture and it doesn't have anything to do with today, which couldn't be farther from the truth. Their culture is almost a one-to-one correlation to our culture. Right? What I want to prevent us from doing is this. It's common for people to talk about current times and wonder how things got so dark. When did violence explode so much? When did drugs and addictions get to be such a fervent level? When did sexuality become so blown out of proportion? Right? And the answer is, it's always been this way. You just don't understand history if you have that perspective. If you just take one of these topics, sexuality, and look at the history of sexuality, you'll see that it's always been pretty perverse, right? 2016 is nothing new. Have you ever heard of the 1960s? That was a pretty crazy era for sexuality. Or before that, the Roaring Twenties. That was a crazy era. Or the Victorian era. Have you ever heard of that? Or France? Just all of it. Have you heard of France before? And if you know anything about Rome, the culture in which this story takes place, you know the promiscuity of that culture is beyond anything that we've done thus far. Rodney Stark, a sociologist, wrote a non-Christian book, a historic book, that says one of the main reasons for the fall of the Roman Empire was the brokenness of their sexuality. Right? That's our culture. Listen to some statistics about our culture and sexuality. I just did five. I could have done 50 or 100. I had a lot of information, but just five. 60% of Americans have had a one-night stand. And now our culture doesn't see a problem with that. And if it's just a physical thing, then it's not all that problematic. But if you go back and listen to the Song of Solomon series that we did, and we see God had seven powerful intentions for sexuality. And if those things are true, then it really does rip us apart. So we're entering into a one-night thing that merges souls, and then you're ripped apart. It's a big deal. Porn is a $13 billion industry. The word sex is the most popular search term on the internet to date. Internet to date. Sounded like Al Gore there. Number four, 85% of Billboard top charts music has some sort of sexual content or message. So we think we're sheltering our kids from sexuality. They listen to the radio and 85% of the songs are teaching them about sexuality. The 50 Shades of Grey has been translated into 52 languages. The Hobbit has been translated into 38 languages, though it's been around for almost 80 years. We use sexuality. We use it for connection. We're lonely people that are not really known by anyone. And when you feel that loneliness, a way to get rid of it is to be active with somebody, a one-night stand. We use sexuality for pleasure, and it should be pleasurable. But if your only goal is pleasure and to receive it, then inherently by the nature of how pleasure works, it becomes less and less pleasurable. You can't just receive it, you have to give it. And if you don't understand that, you're slightly more daft than maybe you knew. We use sexuality for intimacy, and intimacy and connection are very different. Connection is about contact. Intimacy is about belonging. We want to belong, and so we give ourselves away to somebody, hoping that they'll love us and say that to us. And we use sexuality for adventure. We're bored people. We work 40, 50, 60 hours a week. If you work 60 hours a week and complain, you still have 108 hours to yourself. You have money to spend, and so in our boredom, we give ourselves over to something that can't do what we hope it will do. And Mary was no different. Mary used sexuality for money, and that seems broken and dirty to us, but did you not just hear how we use sexuality? She used sexuality for survivability. If she didn't practice prostitution, she wouldn't survive. She uses it for intimacy. It's pseudo-intimacy, but nonetheless, there's a moment where she at least feels like she belongs to someone, and she uses it to manipulate. It's the profession of prostitution. Mary, when she sees Jesus, her response couldn't be any farther apart from Simon's. When she hears Jesus quote Isaiah chapter 42, she doesn't think that Jesus left out the part where the captives will be set free. She understands that Jesus really gets how life works, that most people are captives and we will be captives until this life ends. And so she looks at the lifestyle. She doesn't want prostitution. She hates the position that she finds herself in. And yet Jesus is speaking different than any other man. He's not ogling her. He's not trying to take something that's inherently ugly and just spread some icing on the top and make it look pretty for a moment. No, no. He's promising healing. He's promising that the lame will walk and the blind will see. And he's also saying, this life is really hard. He gets her. He understands her. And then she begins to think, if Jesus can resurrect a little boy from the dead, and my soul is dead, and my life is ruined, and everything that I've done has been dark and crushing, then maybe Jesus can resurrect me too. And so she goes into the presence of Jesus, and she's asking for his acceptance, and he's giving it to her, and then she's asking for resurrection. This is a beautiful thing that happens. So let's peer in and see more of their responses and watch how their responses bring change into their life. This is Luke 7, verse 44. Then he turned toward the woman and said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet." The Pharisees were known as the set apart ones, and they were set apart because they really did keep 613 laws. One of the laws was the ceremonial cleansing rite, where after a day out in the market with Gentiles and in dirty streets, there were jars at the door. And when you'd walk in, a servant or a slave would wash your feet and cleanse you and bring you back into community. And if you were a really respectable person, the master of the house would come and wash your feet. And so Simon, a set apart one, doesn't do this right, this act. And it wasn't an oversight. He didn't forget about this. It's an intentional move for him. But why would he do that? It's a distancing ploy. He's distancing himself from Jesus. He loves his religion. He loves what he's accomplished in his religion. Those 613 laws are precious to him. And Jesus has come and he's trying to eradicate the thing that gives him his primary identity. Now, it's really interesting. Simon wants resurrection. No man, no woman can keep 613 laws and not know that there's something really broken in your heart and in your life if you have to keep 613 laws. So he wants resurrection, but he wants resurrection on his terms that he has earned, that he deserves. How dare Jesus come out and start freely giving resurrection to dead things and making them alive again? This can't happen. And so Simon's pushing Jesus away. He's making a very clear statement. You might be important to some people, but you're not important to me. And there's no way that I'm going to let you that close to me. Now, frankly, and if you are maturing, you understand that frankness is usually mercy and almost always love. Frankly, many of us aren't seeing renovation and change in our lives because we're employing distancing tactics against Jesus. We're keeping some things to ourselves and we're giving other parts of our life to Jesus. And the very fact that we'll give him some and keep some is distancing his ability and his power to move in our lives, right? We'll go to Jesus and we'll say, religion can be yours, Jesus. Give me redemption. Save me from my sins. You can have Sundays, you can have everything else, but look, don't touch my sexuality. You can't have my porn addiction. You can't have my one night stand. You can't have the problems that I'm having in my marriage. I don't trust that you'll give me pleasure. I don't trust that you'll give me adventure. I don't trust that you'll give me intimacy. And so you can have religion, but I'm keeping sexuality. You can have my time, Jesus. I'll serve you some. I probably won't tithe my time. I won't give you 15 hours a week, but I'll give you some. But look, don't touch my money. Don't press on that part. It's not even okay to talk about that. I don't trust you, Jesus, to make ends meet and pay bills if I give to the local church to advance the kingdom of God. We won't make our financial goals. We won't have retirement, money for college for our kids. And so what we're doing is we're trumping the sovereignty of God with our own ability to manage money. You can have my time, but don't touch money. Or maybe this one. I think this is the most potent one. You can have my past, but you can't have my future. Look, they're past things that have been done to me. And they're full of bitterness and they're full of brokenness and they've ruined me. God, I want to give to you what my dad did to me. And I want to give to you what my wife did to me. And I want to give to you what that bully in high school did to me. And you heal those things, Jesus. You take care of those things. To which Jesus says, would you please give me those things? Because I have the power to change those things. And I am currently working to heal those things. And so you give those things to him and he takes them. And it's this huge burden off your shoulders. And then you, after giving him your past, look at today, now, and tomorrow. And you say, you can't touch that. It's my job. It's my degree. It's my career. It's my profession. It's my money. It's my house. It's my car. You can have yesterday, but you can't have today at all. So we walk in today and we walk into tomorrow and we continue this vicious cycle of breaking things and breaking our heart and our soul and engaging in things that aren't full of renovation. And then after that broken thing is done by us, that broken thing has been done to us, we look back to Jesus and we say, what happened today was miserable. It's my past. Would you please take that thing? Would you please heal this thing? To which Jesus says, give me that thing, I'll take it. But look, if you would just give me tomorrow, if you just give me the next decade, I can bring renovation into your life so these things are much less than they were. Don't distance yourself from Jesus. When you do that, you keep breaking yourself. And so what distancing tactics are you employing in your life that is lessening the change that needs to happen? Mary responds this way in verse 38. As she stood behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Being a prostitute is a distancing job, isn't it? You don't survive that job unless you can compartmentalize. You have to become pretty numb to the core of who you are. You're giving your body to somebody as an object. You're objectifying your soul. And on top of that, violence happens to women way too much, and especially to prostitutes. And so this woman has guarded herself. This woman has protected herself. And I make that point to say this. There's no way that a guarded woman like this weeps in public. What would allow this woman to weep uncontrollably in public? Here's the thing. Jesus was her only hope. She was one of the few human beings that had the privilege to finally learn that Jesus really is her only hope. And when you only have one hope, when you only have one idea of rescue, when you only have one last chance, you pour out everything for that one last chance. You give everything for that one last hope. And she sees Jesus as this. And so she goes to Jesus and says, look, I'm going to give you my soul because I don't have any idea what to do. Men have ruined my soul. Women have ridiculed it, but it was me who did it, really. I killed it. I broke it. It's dead. And so I'm going to have to give that to you because I have no other option, really. I'm going to give you my heart, Jesus. I've heard you talk about stone-like hearts, and my heart is not stone-like. My heart is dry-rotted to the very core of it. And if you're not very careful with it, it's just dust, really, and it's going to blow away. And so I'm going to entrust you with this very fragile thing, and I'm going to ask you to do something with it. And I'm going to give you my religion because it's just full of unbelief. And I'm going to have to give you my future because I don't have any hope. And I'm going to have to give you my chaos because there's no peace in my life at all. And so she does this endearing thing that demonstrates that Jesus is her only hope. And do you know what Jesus does? He renovates everything she gives to him. Do you understand the connective point there? That if you want to distance yourself from Jesus by keeping some of these things, and you'll give everything to him, he'll renovate every single thing that you entrust to him. Many of us aren't seeing the change because we've kept too many things. And when you keep things, Jesus is quenched from his work. He's not going to force his work on you. He's not going to make you change. And so he's asking you, see me as your only hope. Give me these things and I'll renovate it all. Then Simon does this in verse 45. You did not give me a kiss, Jesus says, but this woman from the time I entered has not stopped kissing my feet. This kiss was known as the kiss of peace. And so when I learned that, I thought what Simon was saying to Jesus in this response was, you and I, Jesus, are not at peace. But then when I prayed and thought about it, it's something much deeper. You would give the kiss of peace to a respected teacher, to an authority, to somebody you looked up to. And so what Simon is saying by refusing to give the kiss of peace is that Jesus isn't his teacher, that Jesus is not the one he looks to as authority, as God, as king. And so in this, what he wants to do is have Jesus over to his house and be peers with Jesus. Peers decide things together. They negotiate. They debate. And so in Simon's mind, Jesus will come over and I'll show him how he blew Isaiah chapter 42. And maybe Jesus can help me as a peer and he can show me that resurrection trick because that would be a good party trick for me to be able to do. We're peers and we'll figure out how to work out things together. Now, this might seem right on some level, but here's the problem. If Jesus really did live and he really did die and he really did resurrect from the dead, then I am not a peer to Jesus. Jesus is God. He's the King of Kings. He is the bright morning star. He's the lovely one. And the most gracious thing that I can do for you today is to look at you and tell you, you're not a peer to Jesus. And if you'll give your life over to him, he'll know exactly what to do. Because as long as you hold this idea that we're peers, you're going to debate with Jesus and you're going to try to decide things together and you're going to ask him to renovate parts of your life that he can and he wants to, but you're going to get the order all wrong and you're going to mess up things and it's going to cause change to slow or come to a crash in your life, right? Here's what I mean by that. Many times we demand that Jesus heal our relationships. I've been estranged from my mom for a long time, some of us would say. I'm estranged from my adult child. We beg out, Jesus, would you reconcile us? Would you bring us together? And if you'll reconcile me in this relationship, I'll start to trust you with these things over here, and I'll let you renovate these things. To which Jesus says, your relationships are important, but if I reconcile you with your mom, before I deal with the self-righteousness in your life, I'll reconcile you once, and then you'll break it again. And then you'll break it a third time and a fourth time. And so let's not worry about reconciliation right now. Let's worry about your self-righteousness. Because when your heart is finally humbled and peace finally takes it over, then you can sit with your mom and not destroy things anymore. It's self-righteousness that's the issue. But as long as you're debating Jesus as a peer, you're setting the agenda, and the agenda's not right. We come to a place where we see finally the brokenness of our sexuality, and that porn addiction is going to ruin everything that's good, and that one-night stands are leaving us just fractured and ripped apart. And it's not a condemnation from a religious person that makes you feel that way. It's your own heart and your own soul. So you say, Jesus, take my sexuality and fix my sexuality. To which Jesus is going to say, yes, I will. But please understand that it's not primarily an addiction issue that you have. It's a belonging issue. It's an identity issue. It's a child of God issue. It's a your mind issue. And so if I free you from addiction of porn, and you haven't been rightly understanding your intimacy with me and that you belong with me, then you're just going to go back into another thing and another thing. So let's put these things over to the side for a moment, and let's deal with the intimacy issue and the belonging issue and the identity issue. So don't look at Jesus as a peer. If you do that, it halts all the renovation that happens in your life. Instead, see as the king. And let him set the course. That's exactly what Mary does. But Mary does this. Then she wiped them with her hair, his feet, and she kissed them. She kissed his feet. Do you have any idea how hard that is for a woman of the city who had been abused by men her whole life? Do you have any idea how hard that is? It's terrifying. This woman sits before a man and doesn't know what this man's going to do to her. And I make that point to help us understand that it's terrifying for you to bow down before Jesus. But I dare say it was harder for her. I dare say it was more difficult for her. She bows down and does the most intimate thing that she knows. She lets her hair down. And she weeps on his feet. And she dries his feet with her hair. When you dry somebody's feet with your hair, there's no thought in that scenario that you're peer to that person. You don't weep at the feet of somebody and think to yourself, I'm equals with this person. No, it's a declaration that you are great and that you alone can fix things. And that's our belief at Vintage. We do a series on renovation because we believe it's the Father's desire to renovate you, and that Jesus has accomplished all the renovation work already, and the Spirit of God dwells inside of you if you're a follower of Christ, and he's bringing the renovation of Jesus into your heart, mind, and your soul. And so we know that change is hard, and we know that for some of you it feels like Christianity isn't working, but I promise you today that if you will lay down at the feet of Jesus and make him your only hope, that renovation is, in fact, going to come into your life. And then our last stop for our time together today. This is the thing. This is the summary. This is why this passage is in Scripture. Focus, listen, this is important. It says this, verse 46. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. In the first century, a prostitute would wear a vial of perfume around her neck. It was pure nard. It was priceless. It was something they cherished. And theologians and scholars have suggested that prostitutes wore it. It was the thing that would allure their clients in. It was her attractiveness. It was her seduction, to which I could not disagree with them more fervently. If this is her allure, if this is her seduction, why would she pour this out at the feet of Jesus? That's weird and wrong. Here's what I think is happening. If you've ever experienced long-term trauma, not just a single traumatic event like a car wreck or you almost lost your life, but long-term trauma, every single human being that goes through it has to create an alternate reality to place their mind in that position when the trauma is occurring to them. It's a paradise. It's an escape. It's a safe place. And so you create that just to make it through it. Right? This vial around this woman's neck was her safe place. It was her alternate personality. It was her alternate reality. When she thought about the vial, as she was being defiled by men, it represented purity for her. And she knew that her life was broken and dirty. Probably could never be cleaned again. But in an alternate reality, her life was pure. Her life was worth something. Her life was lovely. And so as this trauma happened to her, she would go to that safe place of purity and she would rest there. It wasn't real, but at least it was pure. This ointment was priceless, worth more than a year's salary. And she had this deep understanding that though she was broken beyond recognition, her life was endlessly valuable. Somehow, innately, she knew she was a daughter of the Most High God, and that made her priceless. And so it was her safe place. And she's going through life, and she sees this man speak in a way that's never been spoken before, and sees this man resurrect a boy from the dead. And she runs over to this man and says, "This was my alternate reality of purity. But you, you're the most pure thing I've ever seen. You're lovely. And so I'm going to pour this fake purity out and beg you for real purity. You're the most priceless thing that I've ever considered. And so I'm not going to have this fake facade of pricelessness anymore. I'm just going to dump it out at your feet and hope and pray that you resurrect me from the dead like you resurrected this little boy." So I want to ask you as we conclude, what's your alabaster jar? What's your alternate reality that's not true? What's your hope? What's your dream that you're holding on to that can't possibly be? Jesus wants that vial. Jesus wants that dream. He wants that purity. He wants that pricelessness. He doesn't want to lessen it. He doesn't want to mock you for it. He wants to fulfill it. He wants to give you lasting purity and lasting pricelessness. And if you would bow before him and you would let him lead you, he will give you these things. So each week we've finished our time rapidly by giving you just one step. Just do one thing this week. Week one was, would you own your brokenness? Would you see my own great sin and have the courage to declare that you too have great sin in your life? Own your brokenness. Week two, the step was, you're self-righteous, and self-righteousness is running away from God. And your brokenness is causing you to run away from God. And that's the biggest issue in your life, that you're running away from God. Would you stop running away from God? That was week two. Just stop today. Here's week three, just one thing. Will you pour out that vial of pricelessness and purity at the feet of Jesus? If you're a doubter or a seeker, I'm asking you the most ridiculous thing. Would you bow at the feet of Jesus today and believe? If you do, he will resurrect you from the dead. It's just that simple. It's free resurrection if you ask. And as a follower of Christ, we hew out of stone new places of alternate realities that aren't true. Would you take that and would you pour it at the feet of Jesus and say, this was the thing that I hoped in most and was keeping me from you. You're the priceless one. You're the pure one. Give me yourself. And he will. This is how change happens. And Jesus desperately wants to renovate your heart and your soul and your mind. Would you pray with me? God, we're thankful that you're a God who is here. You're a God who is present. You're a God who's incarnated. You're in this room. The very God who resurrected from the dead and spoke to 500 followers is resurrected from the dead and is speaking to people right here, right now, today. Would you speak to our friends that are doubters and seekers, and would you renovate their souls and resurrect them from the dead? To their own great surprise, they trusted and they were resurrected, Lord. And God, for us as followers of Christ, would you help us identify what that most precious thing is, what that paradise is, what that hope beyond all hope is. And when we take that and just fall at your feet and pour it out and say, Jesus, it was just make-believe. Give me yourself instead and fulfill us. How good you are to us, Jesus. We love you and we ask these things in your name. Amen.